Hey. On the last installment of School Sucks Podcast, we discussed the euphemism, perhaps the most efficient example of doublespeak. With the euphemism, you can entirely distort reality with just one word. But in the world of opinion shaping and information manipulation, the euphemism has a very important but often overlooked relative. And even though this term that we're going to discuss today is technically an antonym of euphemism, it is just as efficient.
You're absolutely distorting my views.
Well, that's real simple. There's wing nuts and there's normal people.
First of all, the NRA should just change their name to the Assassin's Lobby.
He might be the Antichrist. Odds that Barack Obama is the Antichrist.
I'm so tired of hearing about the Second Amendment and the Constitution. If you love guns, just admit it like it's a vice. It's like alcohol or drugs.
But when I see, 9/11 victim family, on television or whatever, I'm just like, oh, shut up. I'm so sick of them because they're always complaining.
They call me hell. They call me Stacy. They call me her. They call me Jane.
Congressman Ron Paul is now the accidental figurehead of the Republican Tea Party, leading the fight to tear down the American government.
That's not my name. That's not my name. That's not my name. That's not my name.
So you are mouthing a far-left position.
And that's all we're hearing about are the people in New Orleans. Those are the only ones that we're seeing on television are the scumbags.
I thought we had gotten rid of this left-wing pest for a while. He's a blood-sucking leftist. I mean, you've got to put a stake through his heart to stop this guy.
I'm in favor of free markets. I think the free market can deliver quality health care
so
at a lower cost.
Legislatively, to shorthand that, you're in favor of nothing.
They call me hell. They call me Stacy. They call me her. They call me Jane. That's not my name. That's not my name. That's not my name. That's not my name.
Because you have a warped view of this world and a warped view of this country.
Well, explain that. Let me give you an example.
No, I'm not going to debate this with you. Let me give you an example.
Why would I want to brutalize and further punish the people in Afghanistan?
Who killed your father?
The people in Afghanistan
didn't kill
my father.
Sure they did.
You want bankruptcy?
Well, let me tell
the number
you.
One cause
no.
of bankruptcy to continue to
no.
be the failure of the health
no.
insurance
no.
system.
You have to understand why health care is so expensive. If you look over the last 6 years, the cost of insurance.
We all understand why it's expensive.
No, you obviously
we get it.
No,
we
you
get
don't
it.
Understand why it's expensive.
The question is.
Every forest fire begins with a single spark, and so did the Tea Party movement, the tinderbox of protesters ready to dismantle the American government and eliminate its revenue system.
Because you've built up this culture of dependency over the years. You
those,
can't turn it off away.
Lazy, dependent
no.
seniors in Connecticut, right?
If the
those
government...
lazy Connecticut
if
citizens
you,
over
no.
65 who refuse
don't
to pay
put,
for their
don't
own
put words in my mouth.
Glick was out of control and spewing hatred for this program and his country using vile propaganda.
So what I want to do is, at least in a temporary way, is preserve what we have and not hurt these people. So listen once again. The only way we can do this is we have to live within our means. We have to cut. I want to cut the war spending of Obama. I want to cut all this expense overseas. I've joined with Barney Frank in this effort to cut spending overseas, bring troops home from Korea, bring troops home from Europe, and help these people who are dependent on the government. I think it's wrong to be dependent, and you're right. It shouldn't happen. We should work for the day when these individuals can take care of themselves once again, be self-reliant.
See,
I practiced medicine before Medicare came in.
That's
and when
the,
we didn't
see,
have
that's
Medicare,
the code language
people
you
were
use
never...
for abolish Medicare. That's just code language for abolish Medicare. You want to get rid of Medicare.
I can preach to you all I want because you're stupid.
You're stupid.
Yeah, you're a cow.
You're a cow.
Hi there, everybody. This is Brett. And wow, that was kind of exhausting and frustrating, wasn't it? In fact, if I look at today's show, I've prepared a real irritating one for you. It's going to be a mainstream media mega mix illustrating today's topic. So what is this cacophonism anyway? Well, it's synonyms, dysphemism and malphemism. They're all rough opposites of what we talked about in the last show, the euphemism. This is where, intentionally, harsh language is used
to distort reality. It could be just a word, or it could even be a phrase. Now, we talked about how prevalent the euphemism was in the language of government and the military and bureaucrats in general. What I realized is that this dysphemism or cacophemism is extremely popular with the mainstream media. They love it. I almost skipped this part because the cacophemism is not technically a part of doublespeak, but because it occurs so frequently in the mainstream media, I thought it was worth devoting, like I said, a very annoying show to. Now, one of the reasons why I think this is important is because sometimes it's very hard to dissect and evaluate the information that comes at us in the mainstream media, and especially if you're trying to help other people do this. So there's a lot of tells, you know, giveaways that pundits and anchors have that allow you to cut through the BS much more efficiently. Sometimes it's very easy to get lost in statistics and jargon and, you know, other kinds of more complicated, fallacious arguments, but paying attention to individual words and phrases can really help expose when the person has absolutely no idea what they're talking about, and they're kind of terrified that you, the viewer, or their guest are going to find out about that. When any controversial or emotional topic is being discussed or debated, you can tell a person who has a certain level of confidence when it comes to their knowledge on that subject. They usually use clear language. They listen to what the other person has to say. They certainly don't try to interrupt every 5 to 10 seconds to distort or reframe the other person's words in some kind of extremely threatening or negative light. No, not at all. When a person has confidence in what they believe, their demeanor is usually very calm and their language is usually very clear. And when you see somebody who is kind of hysterical and they keep trying to use the same negative imagery to reframe their opponent's ideas, that's an indication that they might not have so much confidence, and they might perceive your knowledge or your position as a threat. So learning how to spot these things can be incredibly effective, and it can also save you a lot of work. Reminds me, years ago, Stefan Molyneux, the host of Free Domain Radio, talked about making moral arguments. Now, is that always going to work? No. Are moral arguments always going to work? No. Because some people have been so manipulated by language. What the hell is that? You hear that beep? These people, their trucks backing up and stuff. This city, I'll tell you. Anyway, all right, I think it stopped. Some people might be such victims of language and doublespeak and propaganda that they might just have this way of rationalizing the violence or the immorality of the state, and, you know, that could backfire on you. And they're like, oh, well, I just support violence. When it's done by people calling themselves government, because I've been given a magical vocabulary that makes that okay. And in their private lives, these might be decent people. And in that case, I think it might be worth a little bit of extra persuasive persistence. And in my opinion, that might begin with, you know, exposing some of the techniques that were used to persuade them into accepting these forms of aggression and predation. But anyway, Steph's point with trying to make the argument from morality versus the argument from efficiency was, well, look at all the work you could save yourself, right? You don't have to know statistics. You don't have to be an expert on every subject. You don't need to know how to plan, like, complex infrastructure systems to serve 15,000 people. You just need to, you know, say, okay, well, these are the values that you hold to in your private life. Why do you exempt these people in your public life from them? So this is another way to do that, because you don't have to sit there pausing Fox News or MSNBC or encouraging other people to do that. You can just say to them, listen to the language that they use. Listen to their word choice. What are they trying to do? Is this manipulation? Is this honest and clear communication? And no, it's not. It is not clear language. And you can see that when they are derailed on their mission to villainize their opponent, they get very, very frustrated, and they get very excited, and they start interrupting, and they get pretty hysterical. That being said, I have a great example to kick off the show with. He is America's youngest anchor slash pundit. His name is Chris Matthews, and he's the host of a show on MSNBC called Hardball. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but Chris Matthews, he's only 8 years old. All that adult, deep adult voice, the adult appearance, all accomplished through TV special effects and makeup. He is actually just an eight-year-old boy. And sometimes there's some giveaways. His hysterical tone, his complete lack of knowledge on any subject that he's discussing, the way he talks to his guests. He's eight. And I think that's just like this little inside joke that MSNBC thinks nobody knows about. Ha ha, let's put an eight-year-old on television and we'll dress him up like an adult and we'll just, you know, we'll have laughs about it around the office and no one will be the wiser. But this is a clip of Chris Matthews interviewing Grover Norquist, who is the president of Americans for Tax Reform. And the topic of discussion is raising the debt ceiling. This is relatively recent. And, of course, raising the debt ceiling, the liberals, which Matthews is a part of that group, and the Obama supporters, Matthews is a big part of that group. I think he said on television that he became aroused by listening to Barack Obama speak. Now, I think he just said something like he gets singles up his leg. But when something is going up someone's leg, you know where that's leading. So it's arousal. Matthews wants to raise the debt ceiling. Matthews wants the Democrats to be able to spend more money to temporarily or continue to push off the impending financial doom so that Democrats and Obama can get reelected in 2012. He sees Norquist's organization as an obstacle to raising the debt ceiling. Norquist does not want to raise taxes. Matthews loves raising taxes. He can't wait to raise taxes. And, of course, incurring more debt also means raising taxes on future generations to pay, at the very least, the interest on that debt. So Chris comes out swinging here. I'm going to let this play for a couple minutes, and then we'll talk about what we heard. Again, I'm sorry for this show. This is really just annoying.
Welcome back to Harbor. We're quickly approaching the president's deadline for a compromise on the debt ceiling, and I want you to meet the man who's been dubbed the unofficial enforcer of the No New Taxes pledge, which may be holding up that deal. I think it is. In fact, joining me now is Grover Norquist, who's president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks for coming on. I think we ought to, just to get the people informed in our audience about your pledge, and we're going to read it right now. We have it right now. I pledge to the taxpayers of whatever district or state, to the American people, that I will, one, oppose any or all efforts to increase the marginal income tax rates for individuals or businesses and or business, and two, oppose any net reduction or elimination of deductions or credits unless matched dollar for dollar by further reductions in tax rates. Now, how successful have you been in nailing down Republicans in the Congress to this pledge?
Sure. We've been offering this pledge to candidates for the House and Senate and President for the last 24 years. Today, 235 members of the House have signed the pledge that are sitting in the House of Representatives, 41 senators. So a majority of House members and 41 senators, 1,200 state legislators, 13 governors.
Well, this is the first time it's really had sort of the drama, as you know, and you're probably happy about this. A lot of people aren't happy. Mm-hmm. So explain why you are willing to hold people to this tax pledge, even if it means at least between now and early August, no deal, and therefore a possible default. Why are you pushing so hard at this point on keeping people to their pledge?
Well, because the pledge, again, has been around for 24 years. In 1990, George Herbert Walker Bush signed the pledge, which is why he won the Republican
primary. Yeah, but why are you holding him to it now, at this point, when you were facing this critical situation where many people believe we face a default sometime early in August or sooner, perhaps, and therefore, because there's been no deal in raising the debt ceiling? Why are you holding members of Congress who have pledged to your organization to risk a default? Why are you doing it?
Chris, as you know, because you just read the pledge is not to my organization. You just read the fact that
sure.
The pledge is to the American people.
But you wrote it.
So, yes, and we offer it to all candidates. What the pledge does is allows a candidate who wants to run for office to make a credible commitment to the American people that he or she won't raise taxes.
Right.
Without the pledge, which is the same wording in all 50 states over the last quarter century, a promise not to raise taxes is like any other political promise and means nothing. So the strength of the pledge is not that I or ATR enforces it. It's that the voters enforce it because they know what it means. They've read it. They've seen it.
Right.
They voted for somebody because he or she promised to vote for it. The power of the pledge is the power of the American people, not me personally or Americans for tax reform, but rather that the pledge is not something you can walk away with and say you were misquoted.
Right, you're defining this in a way I understand it completely. You've dramatized, but I'm getting back to this. You have asked people to make an ironclad pledge in your organization. You've written the thing, you've promoted it, you've gotten people to sign it.
Sure.
Those who haven't signed it, you've encouraged to sign it in various ways. You put pressure on it in various ways through grassroots efforts. I assume all that. My question to you is, you hold these people in this organization to this pledge, right? Your organization holds them to the pledge, not just the American people generally. You, Grover Norquist, and your organization hold them, right?
We
to the pledge.
We personally hold them to the pledge. We urge them to keep the pledge.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Wait, what the hell did he just say?
Right. That's what I'm saying.
For the record, that's not what he was saying at all.
We personally hold them to the pledge.
Now, Chris Matthews, who is just hysterical from the get-go, clearly has an agenda here. Grover Norquist is obviously very knowledgeable on this subject. After all, he should be. It's his organization. He was the one who wrote the pledge. And he's trying to, in a very calm and clear way, provide a context for what the issue is that they're currently discussing. Chris Matthews does not want to hear any of that. He wants to keep coming back to this question while using very persistent language, enforcing, holding. He keeps using that word over and over and over again, holding, holding, holding. And to describe Norquist getting congressmen to make a voluntary agreement to sign this pledge, Matthews uses the words nailing down, pushing so hard, preventing a deal. And keep in mind that all of Matthews' doublespeak is superimposed over a false sense of urgency on this whole issue. There's nothing magical about this August 2nd date, and the false urgency was accomplished subtly at the very beginning of this piece with the argument from authority. The president set the deadline of August 2nd. There's nothing special about that day. In fact, Geithner has moved this so-called deadline back several times. So, I don't know, maybe that's why Matthews is so bent out of shape about all this. Because maybe he's looking at this August 2nd date the same way the people with the foil hats are looking at December 21st, 2012. I don't know. Now, through this picture that MSNBC is trying to paint of Norquist and his organizations, Chris Matthews is able to put forward the idea that his position and the Democratic position and Obama's position is somehow responsible and forward-looking, while Norquist is reckless and aggressive. And it's those little words that accomplish that. Now, of course, Matthew's whole premise doesn't even make any sense. This organization that Norquist is the head of could not force congressmen to keep this pledge. And let's be fair, Norquist is engaging in some doublespeak of his own because he said that the power of the pledge is the American people. Well, that's, you know, based on the faulty premise that the American people, if congressmen don't do what we want, we get in there and vote, and voting makes a difference, and we get good people in there who will represent us properly. That's bullshit, too. But I want to point out what Matthew's technique has been up to this point, most importantly. Because once this negative image of Norquist is established through little Chris's word choice, now Matthews can start making some more aggressive accusations.
That because of this pledge that you've arranged people to sign and encouraged them to sign and are watchdogging, this pledge will keep a deal from happening between the Republicans and the Democrats, which will allow the debt ceiling to go up and avoid default. You're happy with this crisis we're in right now.
I disagree with your assumption.
Well, tell me how I'm wrong.
I am glad that taxes will not be raised.
Under any circumstances.
Under any circumstances, of course.
Any circumstances.
Because the president
It's better not to raise taxes. It's better to have a default than to raise taxes. You said any circumstances.
It's better to bring spending down than to either have a default.
They're going to bring spending down. Both sides have agreed. The President of the United States is full force for at least a $3 trillion cut as part of a $4 trillion package. You say, I don't want the package. I'd rather have default, is what your position is. Just tell me if it isn't.
I would rather have the American people move forward without a tax increase and without
and have a default.
And no, without a default. Let's bring spending down.
How do you avoid
down.
A default if you don't if you refuse to raise taxes and the Democrats and Republicans can't make a deal? No, you've been talking quite well.
So Matthews, who, like I said earlier, is just 8 years old, is now, of course, we see him turning to the interrupting and talking over Norquist, who, even though I don't think Norquist has much of a leg to stand on with his whole organization here, Matthews, you can tell, feels pretty threatened by it. But Matthews, in his own mind, and of course I would think that probably in most of the minds of most of the viewers of a show like Hardball or a network like MSNBC, believe at this point that the host has the high ground. So it's perfectly fine for, first of all, this is a fake debate to begin with. Because what Matthews has conflated with not raising the debt ceiling is automatic default, and that's not the case. But that's a whole other subject. But now Matthews can use as evidence, right? Because Norquist is this very dangerous and aggressive figure in the minds of the MSNBC viewers anyway, and he's totally on the defensive because of the words of attack that Matthews has used. Matthews uses as evidence something that hasn't even happened yet, that Obama says he's going to cut spending. Now, he enters that into the discussion here as if it's a fact. Obama says he's going to do this. So this is getting kind of sloppy.
That we should grow the economy and we should cut spending.
So your position, as we go deeper and deeper into what everyone in the world recognizes will be perhaps bankruptcy.
Wait, what the hell did he just say?
Into what everyone in the world recognizes will be perhaps bankruptcy.
That didn't make any sense.
Basically spikes in the interest rate, a reduction in our bond ratings and everything else. Perhaps the bond vigilantes will come in. And all that's going to happen through August. And you're going to stand fast and say, even in the face of that terror, you're going to say, I'm holding my people. I've got 41 senators. I've got 235 House members. And they better not budge because I, Grover Norquist, said so.
Actually, Chris, the American people said so, not me.
No, in your document, you wrote it.
In Chris Matthews' defense, he's only 8. What MSNBC is doing here is actually a violation of the child labor laws. And now that our use of cacophonisms has established that Norquist is a dangerous man, let's start making some insinuations about what else he might do.
And by the way, what do you do to the ones that don't go along with you? You just let them go and give them a kiss goodbye? You blow kiss out? No, you go after them and pressure them, right?
We highlight to the American people who's kept their pledge and who hasn't.
Right. Now, how about people that haven't signed the pledge? How about people who say this is bad policy? Like people like Lugar and Grassley, real conservatives who don't believe in your approach. What do you do to them?
Actually, both of them have staked out a position of opposition to any tax increase. They have not yet taken the pledge.
All right, Chris, let's wrap it up.
To show that American government can work without people like you basically dictating to politicians what they have to sign to avoid your heat.
But Chris,
you're very
successful. It's the American people that have said that, not Americans for tax reform.
We'll see. Hey, Grover, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate you coming on. It's a good argument. I think we've cleared up the way people know where you stand right now. I hope I've helped.
Wait, what the hell did he just say?
I think we've cleared up the way people know where you stand right now. I hope I've helped. Thank you. You're watching Hardball, only on MSNBC.
Now, the approach of somebody like Chris Matthews sets the tone for the rest of the MSNBC network and allows some of their other on-air personalities to get away with even more ridiculous and more intellectually insulting presentations. This next person we're going to hear from, this clip, is a guy named Lawrence O'Donnell. I couldn't even believe that this guy was real. And he's interviewing Peter Schiff, who at the time was planning to run for Senate in Connecticut against the Democrat Chris Dodd. What's interesting is that O'Donnell will try extremely hard, just blatantly interrupting Schiff, if necessary, to present him in an extremely negative light. And any time that Peter Schiff will try to provide context for what he believes and explain why he believes what he believes, O'Donnell will cut him off. And when Schiff tries to explain something, this is a trick that you will see on MSNBC and Fox News. O'Reilly is famous for this. When Schiff tries to explain something, O'Donnell will cut him off and say, oh, everybody already knows. Everybody already knows. When it's clearly he's demonstrating that he has no idea what he's talking about, Schiff is trying to explain or provide context, but the host will not let him. And at one point, O'Donnell will even create a fantasy about Chris Dodd, something that hasn't at this point even happened yet. Then he'll try to enter that into the debate as an argument against Schiff's position. It's amazing. And that being said, we can really see how dysphemisms are really a foundation for other logical fallacies. Because once O'Donnell has painted this picture of Schiff, he can just start making whatever kind of arguments he wants. And he can start just running, because he has the high ground. Schiff is out to hurt people. And O'Donnell is responsible, and he's just taking him to task. He's just being a journalist. Peter, why do you want to hurt people? And why don't you want to cooperate with all of the other politicians who are working hard at finding a solution to the healthcare problem?
Next guest has formed an exploratory committee for the 2010 Senate race in Connecticut. He is a Republican who would challenge Chris Dodd, the acting chairman of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, and the driving force for a public option. Peter Schiff is the president and chief global strategist of Euro Pacific Capital, a Westport, Connecticut-based brokerage firm. He's also the author of the book Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. Peter Schiff, your book coming out in 2007 predicted everything we're going through now with the recession and the collapse in the markets and all of that.
Exactly. And more important, it predicted all the foolish things the government would do to try to solve the problem and why all those things would make the problem worse.
Okay. So let's say you get the money and you're running for Senate in Connecticut in 2010. What's your position on health care reform?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure that Chris Dodd doesn't have a chance to do for health care what he did to the banking industry. You know, the problem with health care is that it's too expensive. And the reason it's so expensive is because of government involvement in the system and because of an overutilization of insurance, because of tax subsidies that force people or get people to buy insurance to cover ordinary medical expenses.
In the campaign, you're going to have 30 seconds to say what you're in favor of.
I'm in favor of free markets. I think the free market can deliver quality health care at a lower cost.
Legislatively, to shorthand that, you're in favor of nothing. You're in favor of doing nothing.
No, I'm in favor of doing something, getting the government out of the market. You have to remember what insurance is for. Insurance is to pay for catastrophic events that are unlikely to happen. People have fire insurance because their house probably won't burn down.
So you want to remove all the government regulations, state and federal regulations in place right now to prevent health insurance companies from abusive practices. You want to let them continue to deny anyone who has a pre-existing condition, to put limits on the policy. You want to continue. You want bankruptcy, the number one cause of bankruptcy, to continue to be the failure of the health insurance system.
You have to understand why health care is so expensive. If you look over the last 6 years, the cost of insurance.
We all understand why it's expensive.
The question is,
what do we do about it now? Is there one thing that you have read in any one of the bills, any one of the proposals in the Congress that you're in favor of? Is there one sentence that you're in favor of? I am not in favor of the government getting more involved.
What I want to do is I want to bring market forces back to play to control costs
and everything you're aware of, and the House bills or the Senate
bills, there's not a single thing that you're in favor of. The bills are bad.
You would say no to every sentence of those bills.
Because all they're going to do is drive costs up further and drive down quality. We need market dynamics.
If they do pass health care reform, Chris Dodd's going to come back to Connecticut as one of the heroes of the health care reform crusade, having left.
And your campaign
will stand there and say every single sentence of the legislation he passed was bad.
Right. I will tell the truth. I will tell the public that there is no Santa Claus, that whenever the government comes and promises you something for free, you better watch out because it's going to cost a lot more than you think.
So you would have the government pull out of the Medicare system. You'd abolish that, right?
Well, I, I'll
obviously, it's a complete single-payer government-run healthcare system. It's as socialistic as the Canadian system.
Yes.
It's for everyone 65 and over. And you would say,
no,
end that tomorrow.
I can't say
you
that, obviously.
Look,
because you built up this culture of dependency over the years. You can't turn it off overnight.
Lazy, dependent seniors in Connecticut, right?
If the government...
lazy Connecticut citizens over 65 who refuse to pay for their own
healthcare. Don't put words in my mouth. If the government hadn't taxed the hell out of these people while they were working, they would have enough money to afford their own health care, and it would be a lot less expensive. We need market dynamics and market forces. Insurance is driving the cost of health care through the roof, just like government-subsidized student loans have driven education tuitions through the roof, just like subsidized mortgages drove housing prices through the roof. The government is distorting the free market. It is the root cause of our problems, and there are no solutions that involve more government. The only solutions involve the free market. They involve capitalism. And health care is important, just like food. We don't want the government growing our food.
You think the massive subsidies that we give to college students in this country to go to college for free, government subsidies,
yes, it benefits.
You think that explains tuitions? Can you tell me? Can you tell me? You're in New York City right now. You know what a private school tuition is for high school in New York City?
All right, I don't want to get too off the topic of doublespeak right here, but this kind of makes my point that I said before I started playing this clip about how doublespeak provides a foundation for logical fallacies. O'Donnell right here commits what I'm going to call a double red herring. A red herring is where an irrelevant topic is introduced to steer the argument away from the original topic of debate. Now, Schiff does mention college tuitions because he's trying to provide a context for explaining how subsidies distort the market. So he talks about healthcare, he talks about mortgages, and he mentions tuitions. Now, O'Donnell, to derail him, wants to talk about tuitions, but not of colleges, of private high schools in New York City. So, first of all, he diverts from the economic discussion to talk about tuition, and then diverts from the tuition discussion to talk about high schools in New York City.
It's over $30,000. There's not one penny of government support to that tuition. How did it get to $30,000?
Well,
how do you explain that?
Well, you might. You're talking about elite private schools in New York City. You look at
the price in this economy as being the product of government intervention.
What about in markets where there is zero government intervention? How does the price go up? If students couldn't get government-guaranteed student loans to bid up college tuitions, do you think universities could charge these outrageous prices if students couldn't borrow money to pay them?
But look, it is such a small sliver of what goes into
the tuition mix. No.
The reason tuitions go up is because teacher salaries go up over time.
But why don't they
go up directly proportionally?
But why isn't there competitive forces keeping them down? It's not basically salaries for teachers. It's the administrative bureaucracy. The beneficiaries of the student loan programs are the universities. And our kids are graduating from college now, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. Why is that a good thing?
Chris Dodd's the leader of the Education Committee, too, so you're going to have a good debate with him about free market education in Connecticut. But just to get you clear on the record now, if you are in the United States Senate now, and if you are voting on health care reform this year, you would vote no to every single proposal made by a Democrat or Republican in the Senate this year.
Well, it depends on the proposal. The ones on the table now,
Is there a single proposal by Chuck Grassley or any of the Republicans in the Senate that you would vote for? Is there a single sentence you'd vote for from Chuck Grassley?
One thing that I would support would be reducing income taxes and then I would tax health care benefits as ordinary income because I want to take away the preference
Chuck
to choose health care. But only
you
if you lower income taxes.
Let's get
you
this straight.
But you have to lower income taxes to keep it
let's
revenue neutral.
Let's get you on the record. Peter Schiff is in favor of raising taxes on Connecticut citizens who have private health insurance.
No, I want to lower taxes. No, remember, I want to lower taxes.
You want to lower the income tax, but you want to raise taxes on health care benefits.
No, but so there's no net increase.
There's zero taxes on health care benefits now. How much do you want to raise them to?
I want to raise them enough to offset the reduction in income taxes. I want people who now get health insurance from their employers to get money, to get wages instead that are not taxed, and they can make a decision if they want to buy health care or if they want to buy something else, or if they want to buy a major medical that covers catastrophic illnesses.
Chuck Grassley a call. He's the leading Republican on the Senate Finance Committee. He, too, is currently in favor of raising taxes on people's private health insurance
plans. But I only want to do it if we cut their taxes.
You have found one sentence of agreement with the Republicans.
Are you listening? No.
And it's on a tax increase.
Are you listening to what I'm saying? I only do it if we cut taxes.
We're out of time. I gave you as much time as you wanted to tell me one thing.
Yeah, but you kept interrupting me.
You told me one thing. Peter Schiff, thank you very much for coming.
You only heard one thing.
Now, did you notice towards the end of the discussion that O'Donnell was very persistent about getting Schiff, quote, on the record? I just want you clearly on the record. But when somebody's going on the record, it's usually because they said something to go on the record. But that's not how it works in cable news. O'Donnell says, I just want to get you, Peter Schiff, on the record, and then doesn't let Schiff talk, but puts his own opinion about Schiff forward, which is entirely negative and largely a distortion. A summary of Schiff and his positions, a summary built upon the dysphemisms that O'Donnell had been using throughout the entire interview. Now, MSNBC has plenty of great attack dogs for all of those people who oppose government expansion and more government control over the economy. But when it comes to those who oppose imperialism and torture and war and invasion, Fox News has the best attack dogs. So here's Bill O'Reilly versus Ron Paul. And O'Reilly's use of dysphemism here is subtle, but actually pretty powerful.
So I think that in our national security situation, we have to assume that Iran is an aggressive nation, that it wants to injure the United States, and is going to use surrogates to do it. Now, if you have an Iran actively seeking nuclear weaponry, as you do, and if you have the ability of that country to hand it off to a Hezbollah or an Al-Qaeda or anybody else, you withdraw from the region, you give them carte blanche to do what they want, do you not, Congressman?
See, I think you're concerned about the wrong country right now, because more than half of the Al-Qaeda that are committing suicide in Iraq right now are Saudis, and nobody even talks about
that. Okay, look, I'm concerned about all the things, but when they're seeking a nuclear weapon, when a country's seeking a nuclear weapon that's a danger to the USA, a stated danger, and you want to withdraw from the theater, that gives them carte blanche to do what they want, does it not?
Well, first off, you have Pakistan, and they're not exactly the most pro-Western
country. But I'm talking about Iran, Congressman. I'm not talking about Pakistan at this point.
Why don't you ever let me, answer
the question? Because you're not directly answering
the
question, sir.
Because, I do not fear them as you do, as many do, because they want another war. They want to spread this war. This has been the plan by the neoconservatives to have this major overall, this revamping of the whole Middle East, precisely the reason the Al-Qaeda is growing. The Al-Qaeda is growing because of our policy. Our national security is threatened because of our policy, and it makes it much worse. So I see the Iranians as acting logically and defensively. We've been fighting the Iranians since 1953. We overthrew their government through the CIA in 1953. We were allies with Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, and we encouraged him to invade
Iran. All right, so I just want to get
there.
We don't need a history lesson, but I do want to get this
on
the record.
But you have to understand.
I do understand the region, man, but we don't have time to do the history lesson tonight.
And there it is. We don't have time for a history lesson. So Ron Paul, who's fairly knowledgeable about U.S. foreign policy, even though I think he's not nearly bold or radical enough when it comes to pointing out some of the horrors and the realities of U.S. foreign policy. Foreign policy, by the way, a euphemism. But this is no good. This is no good for the O'Reilly factor. If I'm Bill O'Reilly, I don't say something like, your knowledge and your commitment to providing a context for this discussion is not only making me uncomfortable, not only making me look like a fool, but also it's really not serving the agenda of Fox News as far as being a hand puppet for the Bush administration on foreign policy issues. But that's not what I want to say. We're going to use the dysphemism, a history lesson. History lessons, we remember them from school, Ron. They were boring. And people who want to give history lessons, what are they, some kind of know-it-all? But, of course, this isn't about Bill O'Reilly putting his opinion forward or doing Bush administration talking points. This is about journalism and getting people on the record.
I just want to get this on the record. You don't fear Iran, even though Iran has demonstrated it can start a war, which it did last summer with its Hezbollah surrogates, and it's stated that it wants to do damage to Israel, wipe it off the face of the earth, and is developing a nuclear weapon. And you don't fear them?
And there you go, Ron Paul. Now you're on the record.
Yes, I worry about it. I'm concerned about it. But what I'm saying is the very policy that you advocate is encouraging that. What I'm saying, Bill, is this. They put it in perspective. They don't have a weapon. They're not likely to get one in 10 years, according to our CIA.
That's not true.
At this point, O'Reilly just cuts him off again to continue pushing the same anti-Iran talking points. Like, sorry, Ron, I'm not just going to sit here and let you put things into perspective while we're trying to beat the war drums to get into Iran. And that's the O'Reilly factor. And you see how O'Reilly and these other hosts can bring their guests down to their level with the use of name-calling and all of this antagonistic language. Ron Paul got sucked into it. Some of the other people we heard from did as well. And, you know, this is one of those shows, this is one of those episodes of School Sucks Podcast that easily could have been 4 hours. And I listened to hours of these news clips and watched videos on YouTube and downloaded a whole bunch. But I don't think we need to go on any further. I'm going to leave you with one more clip from Fox News. It's actually a montage from the movie Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. But before we do that, one question that some of you might have thought of. Doesn't Brett on School Sucks Podcast use this kind of language that he's pointing out right here all the time to talk about the education system, to talk about the government, to talk about politics, politicians, policies? Doesn't he use words like mass murder for war and theft for taxation? Are those dysphemisms? I don't think so. Like, I think if I was calling what was going on in Iraq or Afghanistan or what happened in Vietnam defense or even war, that's more misleading language than saying invasion and murder. In my opinion, I'm happy to hear what you think. Now, I think when one group of people takes something from another group of people or from another person without a clear understanding of what the taker will do for the giver or without the giver's permission at all, that's, you know, for everybody, that's theft. I'm not, like, inventing a new negative language to talk about government and education and politics. I think I'm using a more accurate language. But what I will admit is that this might be kind of a stumbling block in conversations where I'm trying to persuade people, and instead of using a word that they're very comfortable with, like defense or taxation, I use words like murder and theft. It might be worth looking into a softer approach, for sure, if the real goal of those conversations is persuasion. So, if you thought of that, good point. Now, Fox News. Well, after 9/11, there was a lot of kind of passing the blame around, and, oh, nobody ever could have anticipated something like this happening, and we had no warnings. And that was pretty much the chorus from all of the people in the Bush administration, and a lot of people in the Clinton administration, who were involved in counterterrorism. There was one man, his name was Richard Clark, he was one of the counterterrorism advisors to the Bush administration, who, as far as I know, was the only person who went on the record and issued a public apology for the supposed inaction of the government leading up to the 9/11 attacks. Richard Clark, during the presidency of George Bush, said this.
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you.
And Fox News' reward for Richard Clark, for his attempt, in his mind anyway, at honesty and accountability.
When Richard Clark emerged, it was obvious this was a danger to the administration because he had worked at the highest echelons of the Bush administration. And it was almost like Fox News was working off of the playbook coming out of the White House.
that he had to be torn down. He had to be turned into a Democrat, a liberal, a Kerry guy.
He is bringing this up in the heat of the presidential campaign.
Can you assume from what he's saying that he has now become a political operative?
Do you feel that there is a political...
He is, as some have suggested, auditioning for a job in the Kerry administration.
Sucking up to another administration.
He said when he came to me to ask for my support with Tom Ridge.
He had been angling for a top job in Homeland Security Department and did not get it.
See, one of the things that Fox does and conservatives do is they don't have to win every argument, but if they can muddy the argument enough, if they can turn it into a draw, that to them is a victory. Because it denies the other side of victory.
Well, Sean, there are apparently two Dick Clarks here.
Dick Clark has been on three sides of a two-sided issue.
He's totally contradicted himself.
His statements are contradictory.
There's a lot of information that contradicts Clark. And
aren't there sufficient contradictions?
He has written a book, and he certainly wants to go out there and promote that book.
Or is he just out to sell a book?
Who's out to sell his book?
Did he have a motive behind writing the book and going out on 60 Minutes and criticizing the Bush administration?
Actually, this guy's hawking a book.
Unveiling his book.
An appalling act of profit.
This guy rakes Bush over the coals and gives Clinton a pass.
And the book gives Clinton a complete pass.
Easily, Clark treats the Bill Clinton
era. There are some real concerns about where the truth lies and what Richard Clark was saying.
They launched a major smear campaign. In some ways, it worked.
I thought, number one, he was extremely melodramatic and that he was intoning with great pathos. I mean, it almost seemed like it was a performance.
And it was just attack politics on a TV channel. Usually you leave attack politics to a political campaign.
Howard Rove and company are quite good at character assassination. You know, there are all these people, dozens of people in the White House, paid for by you and I, paid for by our taxes, right? Writing talking points, calling up conservative columnists, calling up talk radio hosts, mm-hmm. telling them what to say. It's interesting. All the talk radio people, the right-wing talk radio people all across the country, saying exactly the same thing, exactly same words.
I noticed that. I was watching it. There's a 24-hour news network, and I'm sure it's a coincidence, but what they were saying was remarkably similar to what the White House was saying, and I couldn't help but thinking how funny that was.
And so, we'll wrap up there for today. Thanks for listening. I hope these shows have been helpful and educational so far. And I also hope that even though we've only done two of them, it's beginning to illustrate how doublespeak can be used as a real running start for more sophisticated types of information manipulation and fallacious arguments. We'll continue the series in the next show. Mark Stevens will be my guest. He is the author of Adventures in Legal Land, and he is also the host of the No State Project. The show will focus on the next type of doublespeak, which is called jargon, and we are going to discuss a Socratic approach to defending yourself against legalese, that is, the bizarre language of the justice system. Ooh, that's a euphemism right there. Take care.
No offense, and I know Muslims, I like Muslims, I've been to mosques, I really don't believe that Islam is a religion of evil. I think it's being hijacked, quite frankly. That being said,
I would now like to say something totally bigoted and insinuate that you're a terrorist because you're a Muslim.
You are a Democrat, you are saying, let's cut and run, and I have to tell you, I have been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And I know you're not. I'm not accusing you of being an enemy, but that's the way I feel, and I think a lot of Americans will feel that way.